Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And today we have with us Dr. Louis Muglia, who is a MD, PhD. He is currently the president of the Burroughs Wellcome Fund. Before that, you were at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital doing research and was also a professor of pediatrics, among many other leadership positions. And you've been at BWF, Burroughs Wellcome Fund, since 2020. And so we're really excited to have you here to talk about science, science communication, some of the work the Burroughs Wellcome Fund does. So welcome, Lou. Thanks for being here.
Maggie, thank you so much. I'm super looking forward to the conversation, and I can't thank you enough for inviting me to join you.
Of course. We actually, Shahir and I both met you several years ago. We were down in North Carolina,
yes,
where BWF is headquartered, and got to spend some time there, and BWF helped fund some of our work for our upcoming book, and got to spend beautiful, your campus is beautiful, we're grateful to be there, so we're excited to reconnect and continue to hear more about the work you're doing. So, Shahir has some questions I think we're going to start off with, We'll just kind of see where this goes. I know you have a lot of really interesting life stories and perspectives, so I'm excited to hear more.
So, Lou, we like to start our podcast by asking everybody this question. Is there something that you are reading or watching or listening to right now that you're interested in and, you know, that's kind of intriguing to you that you want to share with us? And it doesn't have to be anything scientific. So anything that you're watching, listening to, or reading?
Yeah, it's a great way to start out because I'm a broadly interested, probably too diffuse individual. And so, you know, I love reading about, I've grown so much in the way I've thought about things. And I've so appreciated thinking about the way indigenous communities think about sustainability and environment and humanity's integration with nature that I'm reading right now, Gathering Moss by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And it's a beautiful book. I read previously Braiding Sweetgrass, which I thought was absolutely amazing. And to me, you know, the insights we get from just paying attention to things we take for granted is so important. There's so much beauty in a piece of moss growing on a tree. If you look at it closely and appreciate the complexity of even these simple, very primitive organisms. And so that has meant a great deal to me, both of those books, I'm Braiding Sweetgrass and Gathering Moss. The other book I'm reading right now is, it's actually very quixotic. I'm very much into thinking about the role of science integrating with arts and spirituality. And I just took a course actually at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California on the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, which was remarkable. It was incredible. It gave me a whole new perspective on what the meaning and message of the Old Testament was. And I'm reading now a book called Reading Backwards, which was written by a divinity scholar who is the dean of the divinity school at Duke named Richard Hayes. Mm-hmm. And his son, Christopher, was actually the person that taught my Old Testament course. Wonderful. And it's about how the Old Testament prefigured the New Testament and how the New Testament read back into the Old Testament. And it's not about history. It's about theology. And I just think there's so much opportunity to inspire imagination around art, spirituality, and then science as being a grounding pin for understanding the world we live in now.
That is so fascinating to me. I actually have a degree in theology that I completed before I went back to school for science. And I haven't heard very many scientists talking about this intersection of spirituality and kind of specifically Christianity in a lot of ways with science. And the Old Testament is my favorite part of the Bible. And a lot of my work as in my theology degree was actually similar to what you talked about, the relationship between the New Testament and looking backwards into the Old Testament. What is something that you learned in that class specifically that you think scientists should know about?
You know, it's about appreciating that there's something greater than what we can explain right now that we know is there and not be afraid to recognize that we can't explain it yet, which doesn't get out of the realm of science. But we need to be humble in terms of where our knowledge is right now and where we think we can explain and not explain. And I think being open to saying, this is a mystery right now, we can't explain it, but one day we will be able to, is really critically important. One of the areas, and this is totally off script probably for you guys, that I'm most excited about right now, is trying to understand what consciousness is. What really does consciousness represent? And there's a neuroscience of consciousness that says, you know, I mean, there's work that says it's in these deep parts of our brain, like the thalamus or sites below the thalamus. But I think that's very much too reductionist. I think, you know, I think consciousness is this amazing sort of self-awareness that goes beyond cognition. Cognition to me is processing sensory information, intellectual information. Consciousness is awareness of being. And what does that really reflect? And I think that requires a conversation across neuroscience, psychology, sociology, the arts, theology, philosophy, and now emerging artificial intelligence, which creates so many opportunities to think creatively about this.
Lou, this is wonderful. I mean, you know, you said it's off script. That's exactly what we like to do here. Just go off script.
Yeah,
we
and just, right at the beginning, just jump right in.
It's perfect. It's wonderful. And we just want to hear you talk more about this because this is really great. And, you know, I think a lot of people maybe listen to a science podcast and they expect to listen to just, you know, here's what we know. But I think what you're really bringing is, and is a very important point, is, you know, saying here's what we don't know and here's what's mysterious. And oftentimes, and those are just viewed by scientists as, well, we just don't know it yet and we're going to get to it, which is something that you mentioned. But I think there's a respect in what you're saying, a respect to the mystery itself and a respect to, you know, the mysteriousness of the universe. And I think that that's just something that resonates with us here.
Well, you know, thank you for giving me the opening to talk about this a little bit. And I'd love to hear from anybody that, you know, listens to this podcast about their thoughts, because I am evolving in this. You know, I didn't start out thinking about this throughout my life, but I've come to this at a later stage in my thinking. But, you know, there's some really amazing things to think about that we don't understand that serve as, I think, a connector between science, spirituality, and the arts. And one of those things is when you talk about the composition of the universe, we say that 70% or so of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. So what is that? We know it's there. We can feel its presence. But we don't understand what it is. So what does that mean in terms of how we think about human existence in terms of a grander design theme? And second, you know, one of the things I always love to ask people, and this is a crazy kind of thing to think about, but I love doing it, is what is the oldest atom in your body? And for all of us, the oldest atom in our body is hydrogen. It happened at the time of the Big Bang. So we have atoms in our body that are 14 billion years old.
Wow.
And to me, thinking about that just sort of places us in this grand scheme of total existence, which I love thinking about as a person. And what it means in terms of spirituality, but also in terms of science. You know, we think about how we explain the world mathematically, which I always love doing because I love the logic and beauty of mathematical equations. And the probably most predictive ways of mathematical prediction for general physical and chemical processes is, you know, in terms of string theory and quantum chromodynamics, in terms of 11 dimensions, not three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, but these dimensions we don't typically appreciate, that science has recognized as being necessary to explain the processes we see every day.
Right.
And so we incorporate all of that into where we want to go with our science, with our faith, with our thinking about creativity and art. And, you know, the arts, and Shahir and Maggie, you have been champions in thinking about bringing together science and art. These are mutually inspirational to me. What we see and what we can explain, what we envision and can explain, and what now AI is allowing us to create images around that we never would have thought about before. So, so much potential right now, so much excitement, so much to do, and just a wonderful place to think about the future.
That's wonderful and very well put. And I want to kind of, you know, take the momentum of what you're saying about all of these open opportunities that we have. There's so much to do. The promise of AI, but also the idea of just the interaction of science into every aspect of our lives. And just talk a little bit about your position right now at Burr's Wellcome Fund. And the kind of work that you, that the fund is doing, the organization is doing to make sure that science is funded, it's funded well. So just tell us a little bit about some of the goals of the Burr's Wellcome Fund, some of the projects that you guys are funding, some of the projects that you're looking to fund, and some of the impact or your favorite things that you funded.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that you're here. Maybe I can first start by clarifying what the Burroughs Welcome Fund is and what it isn't.
Yes.
So the Burroughs Welcome Fund, there's a lot of organizations with the name Welcome in their title. And the Burroughs Welcome Fund, the organization that I am so privileged to lead, began as the philanthropic arm of the Burroughs Welcome Company in 1955. So we are celebrating our 70th anniversary this year.
Wonderful.
But it wasn't until 1993 that we became a separate science philanthropy nonprofit, independent from any company, with a $400 million gift from the Wellcome Trust in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And that trust was provided, I think, because Burroughs and Wellcome, two pharmaceutical entrepreneurs, established the Burroughs Wellcome Company that generated millions of dollars through global growth in the 20th century through their pharmaceutical discovery and drug repurposing packaging. So the Wellcome Trust has an endowment of about $40 billion. We have an endowment that they gave us to start with of $400 million. So I think they thought it was fair play.
Yeah.
But since we started in 1993 with that, we've grown the endowment to about $800 million and given away about $1 billion in research support over that time.
Wow, that's impressive.
And we're very proud of that. And our typical programs are to support early career investigators that we think have enormous potential that are bridging from their postdoctoral work into their early faculty positions. So we have one for physician scientists called our Career Awards in the Medical Sciences. We have one for people outside of biologic training in physics, chemistry, computer sciences, epidemiology that come into biologic questions called Career Awards at the Scientific Interfaces that we think are both very important. We have an extremely successful program for promoting diversity in postdoctoral fellow experiences in the basic sciences, called our postdoctoral enrichment program that's broadly inclusive of diversity, race, ethnicity, geography, gender identity, disabilities, to try to really bring people's life experiences to solve the most challenging questions. But a couple things, Shahir and Maggie, that I'm most excited about is our newer work in fostering new interactions around climate change and human health, which I think is one of the biggest areas of impact right now. It's, you know, impacting everything on the planet, and it needs a global initiative. We're not a big enough organization to do it ourselves, so we're partnering with the National Academy of Sciences, with other science philanthropies, but we just designated about $30 million of funding to go toward developing centers of excellence in climate change and human health. Well, they'll do everything from basic science discovery to implementation, policy change, and importantly, science communication to engage communities that really don't appreciate or have not really understood the impact of climate change on where the planet is going right now. So super excited about that. And then the other area that I'm really excited about that we've just recently sort of stepped into with Shahir and Maggie's early colleagues is this whole area of science and the arts. I think there's so much opportunity for scientists to benefit from the vision, the passion, the artistry of those doing visual arts, auditory arts, to create a sense of wonder, awe at the world we live in that will inspire people that didn't think of them having themselves as a place in science as to think of there can be nothing other than they would want to do. And I'm especially interested in supporting these people I think about as what I call boundary spanning individuals. I enjoy supporting collaborations of artists and scientists that come together to focus on a shared goal. But there are people that work at the interface of science and the arts, Shahir being one of them, my dear colleague Anand Varma at the Wonder Labs in Berkeley, California, supported by the National Geographic Society being another example, that don't fit into a traditional academic home. You know, they're not going to get a grant from the NIH or the NSF, but they're people who imagine how you visualize life. And I think supporting those people to inspire children in classrooms, to inspire new visions from researchers that are deeply invested in narrowly focused biologic questions is just one of the areas we can have the most impact in right now.
Wow, that sounds like a very nice broad range of different funding opportunities and different interests and very, very, really very important goals and, you know, a lot of pressing problems that you guys are addressing, especially when it comes to something like climate change and human health and how the two are intertwined. And I just want to say that, you know, to our lovely listeners, we're recording this episode right now in April, still April, yes, mm-hmm. April 2025. And there's a lot of, there's a bit of how should I say, an uncertain future in terms of the funding climate when it comes to government funding, you know, things like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and other agencies, where now there is new restrictions for funding things like climate change and human health, but also things like, you know, diversity and inclusion. And these are two main things that you mentioned. Do you feel like, you know, first of all, how are you kind of dealing with this environment? And, you know, maybe your thoughts on it, if you feel comfortable saying any of those things. But also, are you seeing a shift of scientists who usually relied on things like the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health in those areas kind of flocking to the private foundations like the Burroughs Wellcome Fund?
You know, it's an interesting time, as I will euphemistically say, given, you know, what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel so much remorse for my colleagues that have lost jobs, that have lost funding.
Right, yeah.
And it's atrocious. And, you know, all I would say is now is a time for people to stay with their core values.
Mm. Yeah.
And we at Burroughs Welcome Fund are staying with our core values. You know, I was proud, and many, I'm sure, that you have seen, you know, Harvard's sort of pushback against the Trump administration's mandates to dismiss all diversity, equity, inclusion considerations in their processes, and then the Trump administration saying, you know, basically we're going to punish you for that by changing your IRS tax status.
Yes.
And you know, to me, this is the time when you really establish your core values. You know, you say what's really important to us as an organization. And these are conversations we've been having over the last few days. So we're not changing at Burroughs Welcome Fund our language around diversity. We are committed to diversity, not just to say we are committed. We were committed to diversity before diversity became a hot topic with George Floyd and other instances. We've been doing this for 15 years. So why would we change our core values given the current sort of controversies? And so we anticipate we will get pushback around this. And we have been identified as one of the 346 philanthropic organizations that are on the Trump list for attention, for lack of a better way of saying it, or investigation. But what I say is I'd be disappointed if I wasn't on that list, you know, honestly. I want to be a representative. I want to have a voice. And now is the time for us to have that voice.
Yeah, absolutely. You say something is very important, that now really is the time to, you know, kind of show what you're really made of, in a sense.
It is. You know, you can make short-term decisions that
Lou, are you still there?
Compromise your long-term vision, mission. And then, you know, the communities we've engaged over time and provided our support to, we want to know we're always there with them. We don't want to think that, you know, even subtle changes in language, Shahir and Maggie, you know, taking diversity out of some of our mission statements and things, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it because that is what we believe. It's not to say diversity for the sake of diversity, but diversity for the sake of discovery. We need voices, life experiences, and different goals to really make an impact. And you know, there's this really beautiful quote by Martin Niemöller that I love. And I think it's very apropos to the time now. They came first for the communists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, there was no one left to speak up.
Yeah.
So I think if we don't all speak up now, we will not be able to have a voice in the future.
Yeah.
Well, I applaud you, and I'm grateful for people like you who have positions of power in the science world. I, you know, am just starting my career, and I check several diversity boxes in a lot of ways. And so it is kind of a scary time, but hearing people who are standing up to make sure that people like me and my colleagues are able to continue on in science and to continue to contribute to discovery is really encouraging. And so thank you for standing up and continuing to do what you guys have been doing for a very long time, no matter what. And I think kind of coming back to some of your earlier points about art and creativity and science, I think times like this, where the pressure is on, where resources become limited, is really where scientific discovery and creativity can push some of the limits that otherwise we've been kind of boxed in, as far as we need to check the list of what the NIH wants. And now without that restriction, there's a lot more freedom to explore, especially in the space of the arts and sciences, science and creativity.
And Maggie, you know, it's really important. One of the things I've been most impressed with, and this was not my vision before I entered the Burroughs Wellcome Fund and was so fortunate to be invited to an initial National Geographic Explorers Summit in January of 2020, just before COVID, was people working in this area of science-art interfaces, videographers, photographers, musicians that bring science and art together. They were so passionate. They had such great vision. And they were doing it just because they saw opportunity there. And, you know, I love the idea of, you know, people with training in science, especially, not feeling constrained to pursue a traditional academic career, but really follow where their passion lies. It may be in science communication, it may be in science and the arts. We have so much need now for fostering science policy, but you need that grounding in the science to begin with. But, you know, I really look forward to people thinking about what I would call non-traditional careers, where you're a PI in a laboratory trying to get your next grant and, you know, supporting the people that you're mentoring and teaching as you go through your investigative experience. I think there's a role for all of that, and none of them are to be undervalued.
Yeah, and I think you, as a scientist yourself and medical practitioner, have modeled what that looks like to have the arts involved in the scientific process. And I don't know as much about your earlier career, but I know now in your new role that not only do you have art everywhere, that you experience art, see art, I know that you also have tried, that you dabble in making art yourself. So how do you see, well, first of all, I would love to hear more about some of the artistic practices you do, but also maybe talk a little bit more about how these worlds of art and science connect in your own life and how do they connect in general? I think you've said kind of broadly that they do, but if there's some specific examples, even maybe in your own work, that you could expound on.
Well, thanks for asking. Maybe if it would be okay, I'll just give a little bit of a biography of my growing up, if that might be okay.
That would be perfect.
That'd be excellent.
That's like one of the questions we were waiting to ask.
Yes.
Yeah. So I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, in the city, and my dad was an electrician, worked for General Electric and Chrysler in the factories there. My mom was a homemaker mom. Who raised myself and my two siblings. And I came from a very Italian background. My grandparents were first generation here from Calabria, Italy. Actually, it turns out my grandparents on both sides, my mom's side and my dad's side, were from the same small town in Calabria.
Oh, wow.
So they were probably like fourth or fifth cousins because everybody had the same name. You know, and when they came here, and my grandfather actually came just after World War I. He was the only person that survived in his platoon. He was in the Italian army in World War I.
Wow.
From that experience. And he was a stowaway on a ship to the United States in the early 1920s and came here as a stowaway. And he had married my grandmother before he left Italy, but they were separated for more than 10 years.
Wow.
He came here, he got a job in the Ford foundry in Detroit, and eventually my grandmother came over and raised a family, my mom, my aunt, and I was the first person in our family to go to college. And my mom and dad were all about education. And they enjoyed the arts. They didn't have the real experience with the arts, but they encouraged me to take up music at an early age. So I started playing guitar when I was 9 years old. Wow. And have been a musician since then, with off and on starts, because I always prioritize my academic career. So I'd do performance when I was in high school. I did a bunch of gigs on boats and weddings in different venues. I played in punk rock bands in college and had a blast playing guitar, and always viewed that as an important part of my life. And thinking about the neuroscience of music and voice and language has always been something that has really intrigued me, about why these sounds sort of resonate with us in terms of our well-being, in terms of our creativity. And went to University of Michigan to be an undergraduate. Coming from Detroit, I could afford a public school with my parents' help at that time. And thought I would be pre-med, but I actually really loved mathematics and was a biophysics major in college. And I had my first experience in the laboratory while I was at University of Michigan, and absolutely fell in love with the laboratory. So I figured, how am I going to do this medicine stuff with my parents understand, with getting a PhD in basic sciences? They did not understand what a doctor in philosophy was at all.
Yeah.
You know, what is this philosophy stuff? And so, I had a fabulous experience in the lab, and I did a thesis project as an undergraduate on looking at the relationship of chromatin fiber packing periodicity evaluated by low angle X-ray scattering with chromatin repeat length, and just had the best mentor there. He was one of my role models. And I hope people on this podcast understand how important mentors and role models are. Right. Because this is the person that really inspired me to think about why things happen biologically. Why are you putting magnesium in this test tube? Why is this nuclease cutting where it does? Mm-hmm. And just really inspired me to think about understanding more than just doing. So I did a PhD in molecular genetics and cell biology, looking at developmental regulation of processes during development. And I just loved that. And it naturally integrated with my clinical interest in pediatrics that I came to appreciate. And when I did my pediatrics residency at Boston Children's Hospital, I spent 6 months in the neonatal intensive care units there. And it made just such a lasting impression on me. There are certain things you don't predict, but they just make a difference in your life. And I saw families and infants suffering, dying, struggling because they were born too early. And I devoted my research career to understanding why babies were born too early. So I did genetics around determining what determines risk for preterm birth and birth timing, and found that incredibly rewarding. We were able to identify the first genes in the maternal genome that determined the risk for preterm birth, but appreciated even more the social determinants that modify risk for adverse pregnancy outcomes. So I've always been interested in understanding how environment, structural racism, nutrition, infection, health behaviors all impact pregnancy outcomes, which shape our futures. And that inspired me to look more and more into integrating sort of these things around science, community, arts, and communicating how we address these really important problems. So when I had the opportunity to go to Burroughs Wellcome Fund, I was able to bring those things together into even bigger areas of interest, like climate change, like science and the arts, and work I'm interested in doing in the future around what human consciousness is.
That sounds fabulous. I mean, it's just your career has kind of taken many turns, going from academia, clinical practice, to philanthropy now. You talk about the role of mentorship, and you know, we've talked here on Rust Belt Science about the role of mentorship before. We've talked about really good mentors and really bad mentors as well in the past, and you know, some of us have had a mix of both. And you know, just tell us a little bit about the role of mentorship, and maybe somebody who's maybe not a scientist, someone in your life that's been really influential.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, I've been so fortunate to have phenomenal mentors in my life. You know, your parents start out as your mentors. And I would actually say one of the biggest mentors in my life was my grandmother. She came here from Italy. She spoke little English. She spoke a dialect of Italian called Guardiol, which is an Occitan language. And when I was growing up, she lived next door to us. So every day when I was home from grade school at lunchtime, I would go have espresso with her and we would talk. And she was just so inspiring in terms of the stories she had, in terms of her interest and intellect, even though she never really had much formal education. And so her, my mom, my dad, you know, they were the ones that really supported me. I remember when I was thinking about going to college, I thought, oh, you know, I'll do engineering because, you know, it's a very mathematical discipline. You can get a job. And my dad said, you know, Lou, you don't want to do engineering. You want to do something. Beyond it. And it's not to my brother's an engineer. I'm not missing engineering. And so, you know, I listened to my dad, and as I always did. But then when I got to college, my mentor that had the patience to put up with me as somebody never having been in a lab, eventually got totally committed to being in a lab through his guidance. And then when I went to medical school, I had two fantastic mentors, Lucia Rothman Dennis, who was from South America, who was just, she made her laboratory her family. She had kids. She was an amazing scientist, critical, but just warm and wonderful. And I had a clinical mentor there too that brought me under their wing. And then when I went to my postdoctoral work, you need mentors at every stage of your career because there are different questions that come up. My go-to mentor now is an individual named Michael Katz, who was the sole survivor from the Holocaust in his family from World War II. He grew up in Poland. His whole family was killed when he was 13 years old, but he managed to escape to the United States, went to UPenn for college, and then got a medical degree. Had a fantastic career as a virologist, chairman of pediatrics at Columbia University, and then vice president for research at the March of Dimes. And he is one of the most broadly engaged, interesting, informative, and funny people you will ever meet. He's 96 years old right now. Wow. And so when I need advice, I go to Michael, because if he's not seen it, nobody's seen it.
You know, Lou, it's wonderful to hear you say that we need mentors at every stage in our life, that no matter how old we are, there's always someone in our community, someone that we really go to. Because I think, you know, a lot of maybe our younger, lovely listeners out there thinking, well, you know, once I get on my feet, then that's it. You know, maybe I'll go mentor other people and I won't need a mentor. But you really make a very good point that you never stop needing a mentor, no matter how old or how wise you are.
And, you know, one thing I'd like to say, you know, I talked about Michael being, you know, 96 years old, and I have peer mentors and slightly seen some of the most incredible mentors that I've had have been, you know, far junior to me in years, but far more advanced to me in experience,
right,
in areas that I don't have the experience. So one of the most extraordinary connections I had with somebody I view as a mentor is when I was at Washington University and had the chance to explore how evolution shaped human pregnancy outcomes. And a friend of mine, a mentor, said, you know, I just met this person, Justin Fay, who's an evolutionary biologist. I don't know where it will go, but you should have a conversation with him. And I did, and it shaped the next 10 years of my research.
Wow.
You know, and again, and Justin was an assistant professor at the time, brilliant, brilliant guy. And, you know, you just get these serendipitous connections that expand your horizons. That's all I can say. And you just have to be open to them.
That's wonderful. And I think we have some time for some fun questions. I think all of these questions have been a lot of fun, but we want to go a little bit out there. Maggie, do you have something?
Yes, maybe shifting topics slightly from mentors, but when we were in North Carolina at BWF, you showed us a tattoo that you had just recently gotten. And it was very cool. And I was wondering if you've gotten any more tattoos and if you could maybe talk about the one that you had gotten when we saw you several years ago and explain the meaning behind it, because it was really beautiful.
Yeah. it's a great question, Maggie. So I'm not sure. I have two tattoos. Oh. So you might have seen the first tattoo, but maybe not the second tattoo.
Yeah, I think we saw the one that was the Tree of Life. But we didn't realize that we have two now.
Yep, I have two. You know, I never in the world thought I would get a tattoo. I mean, I it just wasn't on my radar screen. But I have a dear colleague and friend that I support. He's one of these artists, scientists, most creative people I know. His name is Alvaro Leyes. And he is somebody, again, a National Geographic storytelling photographer, scientist that I first experienced when I went to the National Geographic Summit in January of 2020. And he gave a wonderful talk on his work. And he had a project called The Edge, which was to do a photo documentary of the population that migrated across the Bering Strait down the Pacific coast of North and South America and established indigenous communities there. And we expanded him to do a multimedia installation around that in Spain that is now a book, and it's just beautiful work. But anyway, I went to the opening of his installation in Navarro, Spain, and we were sitting at dinner one night, and I was looking. He was sitting across the table with some other colleagues from the National Geographic Society. And I said, wow, you know, that's a really beautiful tattoo of the Tree of Life you have on your arm. He was wearing a short sleeve shirt. I said, it's really fantastic. I love it. And he said, would you like to get one? And I thought, holy crap, I kind of would, but do I really want, I don't know. He said, I have the perfect person in Madrid. We're going back. You're going to fly out of Madrid tomorrow. I can set up an appointment for you to get a tattoo with this person in Madrid. And of course, the first thing I did was call my wife and say, Lise, would you mind if I got a tattoo in Madrid? And she said, well, if you really want to, go for it. So I went there and I went to see the tattoo artist there. And they put this little stencil of a Tree of Life on my arm. And I really loved it. So I said, what the heck? I'll go for it. And so I got my Tree of Life tattoo while I was in Madrid, had my arm wrapped in saran wrap on the 8-hour plane flight. I was smearing like this lotion on that they said to smear that probably is not necessary. But anyway, it turned out great. And then I said, you know, this needs another something with it. So I've gotten a second tattoo a couple years ago now. I love owls. For whatever reason, I am infatuated with owls, their biology, their lifestyle, their representation in art. Mm-hmm. So I have this really nice owl tattoo on the shoulder of the same arm that the Tree of Life is on. Mm. With I love calligraphy as well. So I have Chinese calligraphy along the side of the owl that says wisdom.
That's cool. Yeah, you did not have that one when we were with you last. So that's really cool. Tattoos are, yeah, you always need just one more. It's kind of what people say.
I hear they're addicted. Like once you get one, you just have to get at least another one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I just got a tattoo to commemorate my PhD defense last year as well. I think I'm due for another
one. What did you get, Maggie?
So one of the molecules I studied in the bacterium Pseudomonas aeruginosa is called PQS, which is a molecule it uses to communicate with other bacterial Pseudomonas bacteria. So I just got the structure of that molecule tattooed on my arm. So
very cool.
Yeah,
it looks really cool.
Yeah, it's just
I have one tattoo on my left shoulder, one tattoo on my left inner arm, and I was thinking about something circumferential to go around, and I would really love to get something like a DNA strand that also has leaves and nature associated with it.
I like that idea.
That would be super cool, actually. Yeah.
Okay. You should definitely do that. I'm sure you can. Maybe next time you go to a different country, you can find a tattoo artist that there will do that for you. Hearing you talk about all these cool stories, places you've been, people you've met, really inspires me as a scientist, because it's very easy to get into the grind and to kind of become really singularly focused on the research, the scientific question, and to not really kind of lift your head up and experience the world. Go see an art show. Go meet somebody for coffee that is maybe not even a scientist, let alone someone out your field. And I'm wondering, is this something that you have done throughout your whole career, as far as making sure that you did interact with other people in different disciplines and practices? Or is this something that you've realized the importance of as you've progressed in your career? And do you think it is critical for scientists at all stages to engage in these kind of interactions?
Oh, you know, I think it's about always being open to serendipity. I can't tell you how many times things have presented themselves in ways I never would have predicted that have changed the course of the way I think. And, you know, you can't force it, but you have to be open to having it happen. You know, it's one of the kind of really interesting stories. I was mentioning my interest in sort of spirituality and science and the arts, and, you know, whether I might want to explore that a little bit more. But I was taking a trip to visit my son and my daughter-in-law and our granddaughter in Chicago. And my wife booked the flights on American Airlines. And I say that because I usually fly Delta. I get upgraded all the time. But she booked us in sort of main cabin because she doesn't fly a lot. But it turned out my wife got upgraded to first class and I was in main cabin. And she said she doesn't want to be upgraded to first class. She wants to sit with me. But they said, oh, it's too complicated. We can't do that. So the person that got reassigned in the seat next to me was the associate dean of the Divinity School at Duke. And it turns out we just had such a fabulous conversation about science, arts, spirituality, about all the opportunities. And she was just going to take a new faculty position at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California. And she connected me with the dean at Fuller Seminary, and I wound up taking my first course there. And it was incredible. And it's just opened totally new avenues for me by being open to this conversation. And I've had other experiences where I've sat next to someone coming back from a meeting on a plane and being open to having a conversation with them where we found a shared interest. And actually, we wound up writing a paper together after that on the structure of a protein he was working on. So, you know, it's just being open to everything that's out there, because you just never can predict.
That is wonderful. It's really nice to hear these stories of just serendipity and coming together. And then it really brings us back to what you said in the beginning about the course that you were talking and how that really opened your mind to what is consciousness.
Yep.
Yeah. Well,
looking forward to, you know, thinking about what consciousness is and, you know, bringing together, again, people from across disciplines, neuroscientists, psychologists, artists, theologians, philosophers, artificial intelligence folks. But it's really daunting. You know, the big questions are always the simple ones. You know, the question I focused on for my genetics and biology career was, what determines the timing for birth? And for no species do we really understand that. Mm-hmm. And again, thinking about what is consciousness, I think we know it's there and we don't really understand what it is. And to me, those are the really fun things to address, things that are hard to solve, but the question is more important than the answer sometimes, and the journey is always rewarding.
Well, Lou, you are a fellow Rust Belter, is that correct?
I am.
Yes, you grew up in Michigan, you spent a lot of time in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, and so here on Rust Belt Science, we like to play a game. It's called How Well Do You Know Your Rust Belt Home State? Would you like to play this game?
I'm afraid to, but sure, it's been a long time since I lived in Detroit, but yeah, go for it.
We're going to ask you a couple of questions, three questions about your home state of Michigan, and we'll see how well you do. How well do you know your Rust Belt home state? All right, so let's see. The first question is about Michigan. Michigan is well known for which of the following fruits? And this is a multiple choice question. So there's three choices here. Is Michigan well known for the kiwi, the mango, or the tart cherry?
Absolutely the tart cherry.
Okay. That was,
an easy one,
that was
I think.
An easy one.
Even
that
I knew that.
All right. So now Maggie's going to ask a second question.
All right. You got one for one. Let's go for a second. Michigan is known as which of the following? The land of 10,000 lakes, the Great Lakes State, or the Mitten State?
Great Lakes State.
That is correct. Even though it is shaped like two mittens.
Yeah.
And you usually point to where you are on a hand.
More like one mitten and then some kind of thing hanging off the top.
That's right. Yes, the Upper Peninsula.
I've spent a lot of time in the Upper Peninsula, actually. More time than the mainland.
Lower Peninsula.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Lower Peninsula.
Okay, sorry.
LP.
All right.
Well, we have one last question for you. And if you get this right, then you win. Well, you're already 2 for 3, so you know you're doing great. All right, how about this one? Michigan is known for having which of the following? Is it A, the only floating island in the world, or the only floating national park, or the only floating post office?
Wow.
That's tricky.
Only floating island, only floating park.
Uh-huh. Or post office.
Wow, that one is a hard one.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. It's a little bit out
because
there.
I don't know where else would have. I know there's floating islands all around Michigan. I know there are floating parks around Michigan, but there. So I'd have to go with post office because I don't know what other place would have a post office that's floating.
You know what? You are correct. That is, Michigan has the only floating post office. Believe it or not, yeah, it is. It's called the J.W. Westcott II, which is the only floating post office in the world with its own zip code. It's 48222, if you care to know. And it delivers mail to ships in the port of Detroit, believe it or not.
Wow. So I grew up in 48205.
Yep.
It was my zip code growing up. I thought you were going to ask me like some stuff like... what's the state bird of Michigan? What's the rock of Michigan? And those I remember. So the robin is the state bird of Michigan, and the Petoskey stone is the state stone of Michigan.
Wow, we like to get really weird on this show.
All right, Lou, I have one last question that's not related to Michigan that I would like to hear your perspective on. I think your experience, both as a physician and clinical research and now in this new space of philanthropy and funding scientific research, and your passion for science communication and public engagement. And that's what we're passionate about here on the show, too. So if you could see one major shift in how the public engages with science over the next decade, what would you hope for? And what role do scientists play in fostering that engagement with the public?
Yeah, it's the big question, Maggie. It really is, you know. And, you know, the thing I like to say is I would like to have everybody appreciate that science isn't just for scientists. Science is part of being a global citizen, about being a member of the community so you can understand the world, understand. A lot of people talk about trust in science, and I want to be clear on what that should mean. The messages of science change because we get new knowledge. It reshapes our thinking. Our understanding evolves. And it's not a mistake. It's a process and an evolution and a journey to discovery. And having people understand and trust the process of science, the process of seeking truth, is super important. And having communities understand how science has changed human well-being through the ages. You know, vaccines being one of the most critical contributions into how we've survived. I mean, it's changed the landscape of COVID, which we've forgotten. It's changed the landscape of polio. It's changed the landscape of human health that we are now going to see diseases we haven't seen again in a while reemerge. Right. So just having people believe that these discoveries, these avenues that have advanced human well-being are important now as ever. We shouldn't dismiss them with false rhetoric. And there's more to do. There's more to do in the future to benefit all, leaving no one behind.
That's very well put. Thank you, Lou.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time and your insights. And we were very excited to have you here. You have so much to share and inspire other scientists and non-scientists to engage with science. So thank you so much for your time. And I really hope that we get the chance to speak to you again at some point and maybe come see you again when we visit North Carolina. So, thank you so much, Lou.
Well, you have an open door. I was telling Shahir, would love to have you guys visit me at my home here. It's one of the things I enjoy doing because I think we are a community. It's more than just a transactional event around science, art, where we are and who we are as people. It's about really making personal connections. And thank you for your doing around this podcast. I just enjoyed the questions and value the work you've done in bringing this forth to a greater public.
Well, thank you, Lou, and we'll definitely take you up on your offer soon enough.
Yeah. All right. Until next time, Lou.
All right. Take care, guys.
You too. Yeah. Bye.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.